two more small announcements, and then a small swan song. Chris Mannion called my attention that he had found a black notebook. Was it in this room, Chris? In the other room after dinner last night. If someone lost a black notebook, will they please see Dr. Mannion, who's seated right over here? The second thing is that there's a large supply of copies of the New Intercollegiate Review Symposium on the present state of the American right. Those of you who would like copies, please come up and get them after I get through. My remarks for this afternoon, as you will note from the program, carry the title Rhetoric and Respectability, Conservatives and the Problems of Language. Since November of 1980, conservatives have been struggling with the problem of adjusting their public posture so as to reflect changes in their situation. Following electoral triumph and the dramatic shift in the temper of their countrymen, which produced so many encouraging results at the polls, they have been obliged to represent themselves through the spoken or written word in a very new light, as figures operating inside the current of history, not against it. I make here, of course, a distinction in rhetoric. In particular, conservatives have had difficulty in moving from the forensic into the deliberative mode, from the speech proper to critique of the accuser who defends his right to exist with a censure of those in authority, into the language of those who are themselves, if only in most cases through surrogates, in power. Our custom as conservatives, indeed our occupation, our vocation, in the narrow and religious sense of that word, has been to inhabit the wilderness, there crying out against interlopers who occupy the citadel and dispossess the rightful heirs. That role we understand perfectly, and the sound which it makes, a prophetic song of wrath to come. Moreover, we have learned how to suggest in general terms a view of the political things very different from that of our adversaries, an idiom for political campaigning, if not for policy. But what we should say about or to or in support of a government which we helped to create and which is at least officially appreciative of our labors in its behalf is a mystery beyond our ken. And most especially since it is a government which has been forced to do its work while hamstrung by the standing edifice of an omnicompetent state, a hostile filter through which it must translate its will into action or else surrender to the inertia embodied in that mighty Leviathan. Without being understood on our own terms, according to any discourse we could recognize as appropriate for the exposition of our cause, conservatives have, in these last 5 years, experienced political success, popular approval, and a limited but exciting influence over the operations of government, inside and outside the executive, judicial, and legislative branches. Moreover, in playing at least a symbolic role in the conversations surrounding many issues, one or two of us invited now and again to appear on the evening news, issues of national importance in the conversations, in such conversations, they have also achieved an unprecedented visibility. But a new language answering to their new circumstances they have not yet discovered. Instead, in discussing the merits of particular measures, decisions, or approaches to the public business, too many conservatives accept by default, for lack of the necessary alternative, a rhetoric and a language which attach naturally to the politics of their enemies, the source from which they are derived. This is a rhetoric and language for administration, which has long been a given and uncontested feature of the Washington scene, organized not only by a texture, a set of images, a series of modifiers which color it in a certain unmistakable way, but also, and more importantly, by submission to a network of ultimate terms, what Richard Weaver called God terms. inside of this verbal mesh, there is no place for consideration of the common good or a prior loyalty to the Constitution of the United States, the loyalty which all of our public servants proclaim as a condition of the office or assignment which they are expected to perform. Nor is there in such a closed system or overlay any room for prudential restrictions of the kind which mitigate against the absolute claims of ideological shibboleths, or for a law that limits law in its scope and agency, what may for good causes be attempted in its name. It is a convention of the theory of language that our apprehension of reality and our ability to express it are conditioned or shaped, directed, restrained, and enriched by the idiom into which we translate it. We translate such perceptions. Each language, as a system, has an intrinsic capacity to sharpen our awareness of certain realities in society, in the natural world, in the soul, and to render the particular angle of vision implicit in its prescriptive structure. To put the matter in simple terms, it is easier to think or say some things in French, others in German, etc., others in sociology. Formally speaking, there is a consanguinity between what is said and how we say it. Literary critics narrow this generalization down into an observation about the language of period or particular writer. It also applies to the verbal constructs which belong to a particular region, social station, occupation, or school of thought. The latter are more specialized configurations ordered specifically by a sharing of values and objectives. I prefer to describe each of them as a universe of discourse, meaning by that no more than the familiar proposition in epistemology that what we are shapes what we see. Writes Weaver in his essay, Languages Sermonic, "We are all of us preachers in private or public capacities. We have no sooner uttered words than we have given impulse to other people to look at the world or some part of it in our way." The dilemma of conservatives speaking for their government about what that government might or should do is that they lack the requisite technique for deflecting out of its tyrannical, demanding mode the rhetoric of ultimate terms, and have forgotten the alternative political principles which would lead to the recovery of that technique, to a recollection of the method which follows from the vision of right order which they supposedly affirm. This now familiar rhetoric is what Michael Oakeshott calls teleocratic. Indifferent to the harm which might be done to our political and social structure by insisting on the absolute priority of realizing certain ideological goals, the Greek word telos, or end, regardless of impediments to such a realization built into the American regime. The best response to this pleading is the argument that society must be preserved and protected if it is expected to facilitate the application of sound principles to the public sphere, that such a labor of preservation comes first and sometimes requires balance in the competing claims of various absolute terms which have a standing among us. It is an argument which fulfills itself in bringing cries of outrage from the devotees of these familiar abstractions, and a response which is legitimately rhetorical, assuming, that is to say, that certain questions are not open to inquiry, invoke therefore to confound a dialectic only disguised as rhetoric, what the left has established as the primary language of American politics. The conservative alternative to this discourse qua effrontery is what I have called here the rhetoric of the common good. It has a theoretical ground in what the church once spoke of as the doctrine of cupidity, a doctrine concerning the sin of giving preference to a lesser as opposed to a greater good or obligation. With reference to three of the most potent of these ultimate terms, peace, charity, and tolerance, in the sense of a special concern for various groups ostensibly disadvantaged by our economic, social, and political system, I will illustrate what I mean by the foregoing distinction between kinds of language. I will suggest how a proper rhetoric should operate in restoring the political conversation of our time to that conversation, the character it should exhibit, in balancing the always conflicting priorities of statecraft, and explain why, though peace, generosity, and brotherhood are by definition preferable to carnage, selfishness, and bigotry, we are always obliged to ask of measures designed to further these ends at what cost and at whose expense in weighing their advisability. It is an unavoidable truth of the present political scene that when ultimate terms such as the three here in question, or their synonyms, are invoked in debate over a particular issue, brought in, sometimes illegitimately, but just brought in, conservatives who worry about the craft of governing are often paralyzed with the fear of being disreputable, forgetting their obligation to defend the inherited way of our culture, to oppose what threatens our security against the invader, our social peace or economic stability. They are reluctant to forfeit the legitimacy of policies for the present, policies in which their to which their reputation may attach, which they have in mind by offending against what they conceive to be sacrosanct boundaries. Their primary nightmare is that of being accused of bigotry, of warmongering, of insensitivity and indifference to suffering, of being identified, in other words, as persons without ordinary human fellow feeling. And thus they are diverted from the first order of business to preserve, protect, and defend by being put on the defensive, able to make only arguments which object to the labels, not analyses which discredit the measures favored by their opponents. In the process, all interest in what is the characteristic virtue of their situation in life is lost. There's no more potent example of the usefulness of the rhetoric of the common good than what occurs in the context of a conversation concerning war and peace. It is an axiom of American politics in our time that any political leader who wishes to see this country use military force to achieve its purposes can expect to be put completely on the defensive. There's a large component of our population which will not go even so far as to agree that nations have a right to protect themselves, a right to survive. As never before, it is now possible for American politicians to inhibit or frustrate the military policy of any administration in power with the specter of body bags, the prospect of escalating terrorism, the possibility of long campaigns, or the ominous shadow of mutually assured destruction. In Washington, there is a large disarmament lobby supported by choice spirits who either doubt that any cause is worth the risk of their lives, or who in their refinement believe that a foreign policy can be built on nothing more than our unwillingness to kill. Many of our countrymen are so impressed by their own horror of violence, their private rectitude, that they will barely agree to let the rest of us oppose the violation of our borders by an armed enemy. As to our role in preserving the ability of other men to make such recherche and special choices by supporting among them a liberty on which our liberty depends, the moralists of peace make no concession whatsoever that they might hate war so much as to bring it down on the lives of other men does not occur as a possibility in their calculus, nor that they might be surrendering the life and liberty of others by insisting that the government of their country submit to the test of their personal moral judgment. By maintaining that it is possible to love peace privately, so much that you get war, which others may fight, must fight, and by reminding that we cannot improve our country by arranging for its destruction, we invoke the rhetoric of the common good and reduce to a matter of almost no importance, to a tautology, the self-evident truth that peace is to be preferred to war. It is to be hoped that the events of the last week have brought us further out from underneath the shadow of Vietnam. But the collective pacifism brought on by the form of that Asian defeat is not fully behind us. The simple truth and the oldest locus of distinctions concerning the common good, except for those having to do with crime, that a condition of membership in a society is a willingness to fight against its enemies, runs directly against insistence on a right of conscience to pick, according to our own scruples, which of the nation's wars will also be our wars. We may, of course, grant our countrymen an exemption from military obligation, as we grant some rights to residents of the United States who are not citizens. Such are gifts. But it is a given with organized societies that personal preference for peace has never left the citizen of a nation engaged in conflict at peace. Even if he insists that he gives his allegiance only to what his country might become, its dream of itself inside the millennium. Such is Dante's point in Canto 7 of his Purgatory. There Henry III of England is condemned for much praying and piety when it was his office to order the kingdom and defend its frontiers. There's another similar story from medieval times where a prince neglects to raise his standard when Vikings come a-plundering and instead goes often to hear the mass. For the good of the realm, his barons hack him down in the midst of his devotions. The clergy avert their eyes from this sight and complain not at all. Then as a new king crowned, his standard raised and the invader repelled wherever he touches the land. In his cupidity, the dead prince enjoyed such a lofty spirit that he lacked the virtue necessary to fulfill the obligations of his office. He was an embodiment of peace and love to the hurt and injury of other honest men in whose name he had no right to turn his cheek. In such instances, the rhetoric of the common good allows for dynastic change and restorative revolution, even though raison d'etat is often the pleading of despots, and I admit, must be invoked with a caution, supported always by a clear argument from consequences. The same line of reasoning bears upon ill-advised and disproportionate insistence on measureless charity and the organized forms of public and private largesse that applies to uncivil, solipsistic opposition to war. That our economic system must be protected from the inappropriate and unreasonable strains which might be put upon it by too many demands for distribution of the world's goods is quite clear to those who realize that the development of the third world countries and the continuation of their independence is not possible without the dynamic engine of the American market economy. There could be no clearer instance of cupidity than for us to so overdo our collective generosity that we mortally injure that mighty machine and thus lose the ability to defend ourselves or assist our neighbors. If charity is good, it does not follow, even if such charity is needed, that more charity is better. The notion that need creates a right to whatever might answer to such demands holds up only under very special circumstances. If we recognize how much the future and freedom of the rest of the world hinges upon the presence and persistence of the United States as a nation both rich and powerful. In this sense only, need and hope for freedom creates or fosters right the power and prosperity of this country. No more obvious instance of a connection between the doctrine of cupidity and the rhetoric of the common good could be found. Moreover, it is through such pulling away from the particular emotionally compelling instance, the starving child stuck up on the TV screen, that the rhetoric of ultimate terms is most easily exposed as the mischievous simplification which it is. A wide variety of absolute terms which assert their authority inside the conversation that is today's American politics could be introduced at this point. I might complete my illustration of conflicting varieties of rhetorical strategy more or less suited to the discourse of conservatism by speaking of science or progress or even reason, to mention only a portion of the possible list. But none of these powerful abstractions could function so well or with such force in summary and peroration as the one which I now invoke. Tolerance with respect to the status of minorities or freedom from prejudice has become the sacrosanct value in the moral lexicon of contemporary America, and is thus also the cause of our most exceptional violations of the rhetoric of the common good. Opposition to any measure which claims to serve that lofty purpose is treated, as my friend Senator John East recently remarked, as if it were an offense against religion and revealed truth, as such offenses were understood in earlier times when they were likely to be punished with fire. Those who would insist on preferring a greater to a lesser good, the protection of the Constitution, and thus all of our liberties, to relief for the distress of a minority at the expense of the Constitution, great courage is required. As Bill Buckley recently reminded us in writing of the career of his friend Senator Barry Goldwater, column of September 16, 1985, opposition to measures proposed To aid the Negro will be, after the fact, invariably interpreted as racism, regardless of the dubious constitutionality of these laws or court decisions. And it's not only laws which are designed now to help the Negro. It could be for women or whatever. The list is endless. Which is precisely why the left has attached so much of its contemporary agenda to an argument against prejudice, even when racial or sexual or other distinct considerations are not germane, are not at stake, are introduced gratuitously. To apply the rhetoric of the common good to the last 30 years of the Civil Rights Revolution is to ask whether the changes produced by court and Congress in the official situation of the American Negro have been worth the danger to us all, which went with these transformations of the United States Constitution. The risk of converting a nomocratic procedural government into a power able to attempt whatever it thinks fit, into a teleocratic instrument ready and able to do whatever it defines as good. It is to ask whether the tradition of restricted federal authority produced and nurtured by 200 years of American history must give way because the grievances or misfortunes of one segment of our population are more important than limitations on the scope and outreach of the law which honor the liberty of all free men, or at least attempted to do so before the fundamental law was reconstructed by judicial ingenuity into something new and strange. And to question further what unexpected things hurried through the door, shielded by proximate talk of civil rights, after legislation and the rulings of various courts broke it down and allowed mere politicians, administrative and judicial politicians as well as legislative, to think of the Constitution as law always unfinished, like a big turnip, but with no end to its growth. The proper response to such confusion in constitutional morality lies not in praise for civil disobedience, a scandalous act on the part of conservatives, or pictures of Dr. King to decorate our walls, but in what Judge Brevard Hand has written of Mr. Justice Stevens' time-serving concurrence in the case of Runyon versus McRae, that a true court of American law feels a stronger tug from the Constitution, which it has sworn to support and defend. So men may reason in applying the rhetoric of the common good. There are, of course, prudent arguments which work in an opposite direction on all three of these questions. I say prudent arguments, not teleocratic arguments. Arguments which amount to more than a noisy litany concerning natural rights. The doctrine of cupidity may be answered without recourse to ultimate terms, and the nature of any conversation concerning policy alternatives brought back within legitimate boundaries where the norms important to conservatives, another set of norms, will also get a hearing. In such exchanges, conservatives will be on their own ground, ready with a way of dealing with conflicting principles, with, for an instance, the balance between the legitimate rights of persons disadvantaged by reasons of color and by color alone, and the essentially conservative desire of a mother to keep her children away from schools where nothing is to be learned but vulgarity and violence, desperation, and the logic of racial hatred. On these grounds, we may concede a little generosity in the name of that larger community to which all of us belong, and in which we must be allowed, must be allowed a share in place if they would have it. On these grounds, but not any others. Concerning these three issues, war, charity, and tolerance, I have not changed my mind since I was a graduate student at Vanderbilt almost 30 years ago. Not my mind or my method of arriving at such conclusions, the way in which I reason with regard to political abstractions. My eccentricity is, I suppose, thus in not having participated in the mysterious metamorphosis or fusion with the enemy, which separates my politics from those of so many younger conservatives, men and women, who have invested in government as it is, have forgotten what the word means, or else never knew. Therefore, it should not be at all surprising that, like Joe Sobran in the 30th anniversary issue of National Review, I have for today acknowledged the necessity for a dose of radicalism, seen advantage in attempting to shock some of you back into focus and away from identification with the pale parody of conservatism so popular in Washington City. With Paul Gottfried in this most recent issue of Intercollegiate Review, I insist we should defend our version of conservatism with language and arguments suited to our purpose, language and arguments which derive naturally from that which we would conserve, and that we attack at every opportunity definitions of political respectability which have their ultimate origin in the father of all lies, whose other name is confusion, and who offered our Lord a power to do good in this world if he would honor evil, the evil from which that power came. Thank you very much. We are adjourned until we're supposed to be next door, which is shortly.